Okay, so today I'm going to be talking about one line of my research, which is learning by comparison. And I want to start with these adorable ducklings. Just this summer, in around July, my research community, as well as the media, get really, really excited about these new findings. And what these findings are actually show us is that adorable ducklings have abstract thoughts because they can spontaneously perceive abstract relational concept like same and different. Had the journalists, and this is really indeed exciting news for my research community, and as you see the media pop up, actually pick it up right away. So I would say, had the journalists actually dig just a little deeper and ask me, they could make this story even sexier and more sparkly, because just 2 years ago, I actually published work that showed that 2 and 3 year old humans could not do what the ducklings can do. Okay. So the ducklings and the humans were tested in the almost exact same way. I'm going to walk through it so you know what is it like to test abstract concept among very young children and ducklings who could not speak. Okay. So this is the test. And this test is the same for the ducklings and for the children that I tested. This is called relational match to sample test. So if I give you a sample AA and two choices, BB and CD, and I ask you, please pick the choice that matches the sample, and the letter can stand for anything. Which choice would you pick? BB, thank you. Yes, I will ask you to participate a lot so that you really know what kind of test we do. So obviously this is a very, very easy test, right? And why is it called abstract relational concept? It's called the test of abstract relational concept because you match not based on things that you can see like color or shape, but you match based on relation. There's a relation sameness in AA, and there's a relation sameness in BB, so you match the relation to the relation. So this is called the relational match to sample test, first coined by Primack in 1980 to test these very fundamental relation, because you need to know same and different to go around this world very productively, to test these very fundamental relations with animals. So do animals have abstract concept? And only recently they tested this with ducklings, and only 2 years ago, we actually tested this with children. So this is with the ducklings. In case you're interested, what they did is using imprinting method. So the ducklings were imprinted either to a different concept or to the same concept, it doesn't matter. And then they will be tested. So if they're, let's focus just on this side. If they were tested on different concept, on the same concept, BB, then now they see completely new things, right? They said they are different color, they are different shape, CD or EE, and if they know about their relation here, then they should prefer this relation EE. And what this study by Martin and Kachelnik in Science showed that they actually do, if they've been imprinted to BB, they will go to EE. With the children, so that's how it looks like. With the children, the 2 and 3 and 4 year olds that I tested, we didn't have to do imprinting. In fact, humans do not imprint, but we can just simply ask them. So I gave them a picture card that contains AA, and then there is a BB and a CD, which simple shapes that they know, and I simply asked them right away, which of these is the match for the sample? Okay. And when we did this, we were absolutely certain at the beginning of the experiment that, of course, children would get this. Nobody has ever tested this since the 1980s. The assumption is this is a really easy test, and we just wanted to have this as a baseline and move on to something else. But much to our surprise, and this is why the children were tested, but much to our surprise, this was the result that we got. So on the y-axis, you see I draw the proportion of the time you choose the relational match, which is the BB, okay? And 50% is the chance line. So you can see that the 2.5 and the 3 year olds, unlike the 4.5 year olds, were just choosing randomly. They were at chance. And we are very surprised, but we have replicated it. We have replicated this study to get the same results. Other lab, including a lab at Harvard, actually replicated this study after my study and found the same thing. So for 2 year olds and 3 year olds, they did not spontaneously perceive relational sameness. So we could either go say, well, kids are just dumber than ducklings, Or we could think about something else. And so we were not giving up on our kids yet. so we came up with a hypothesis that perhaps they couldn't spontaneously perceive it. But what they could do is they could actually learn these very quickly. So we were very interested in the learning mechanism. So one of the learning mechanism that I would be talking today is comparison. And so what we did in that original study is we gave them comparison. So we tested a new group of children, but they are of the same ages. And this is important. It's not that the children grew up and become smarter like you do. No, these are the same age children, except we gave them an opportunity to compare. So same task as before, but you see now there are two samples, okay? And we encourage them to compare. See how this one looks like this one. And usually 2 and 3 year olds didn't answer anything because they are young. But we still test them anyway, and we ask which of these two are the same, are like the samples, okay? When we did this, we got a very surprising result. Again, with just this very simple manipulation of comparing two samples, children are now the 2.5 year olds and the 3 year olds, again, same ages that you saw before failing this relational match to sampledness, are now successful, okay? Just given comparison, they are now choosing above chance, reliably above chance, their relational sameness. So they could learn to perceive this relation sameness from comparison. In other words, this study shows that comparison can give you what this is called, abstract relational thought. And if this proposition, if this hypothesis is true, it can be very, very powerful. Because abstract relational thought, as abstract as it is, paradoxically, they are very, very concretely present in our lives. So relational concept is very pervasive. It's not only same and different. There are a lot of relational concepts. You should know the same and different to go about this world very successfully. But you also use relational concept in many things that you may have not realized before. So here's just a couple of examples. In language, every time you use verbs, you actually are invoking relational concept. The verb gives you a relations between the giver and the givee. If you understand the relation wrongly, you may not understand the verb. So all verbs are actually relational concept. If you use prepositions, if I tell you that the book is on the table versus in the drawer, you are invoking a different kind of relation, right? The on relation and the in relations are very different from each other. In different languages, this relation may be coded together. Like in Spanish, you will have on and in as en. But in other languages, as in Dutch, you actually have the on separated into two different kinds of words. So prepositions also encode relations. You need to be able to know relational concept whenever you use the prepositions. Even nouns, things like bridge and barrier, you do not describe it in terms of how a bridge looks like, but you describe it in terms of its relational properties. Okay. Obviously, things like in chemistry, in physics, in mathematics, in many domains, relations are very prominent. In chemistry, if you have the same atoms, identical atoms, but connected in the same way, but with different relations, you get different molecules, like cis and trans, right? And the relations dictate this. When you read maps, you need to know the spatial relations. You also need to know that the spatial relations between the landmarks on the map actually corresponds exactly to the spatial relations in reality. So relations between relations are needed even to be able for you to understand map reading, to be able to read maps, essentially, and know what it means. Lastly, even in arts, right, you use relations a lot to judge, to produce art. You use compositional relations in order to judge whether the art is worthy or aesthetically enough and also to produce it. So relational concept is very pervasive. And this is what makes studying relational concept, how do we get to the abstract relational concept, really fundamental, interesting, and challenging. Okay, so today, what I want to convince you is that comparison, I'm putting it as a question, can comparison account or promote learning of all these abstract relational concepts? In order to do that, I actually want to look at the theory about what is comparison from a cognitive perspective, what actually is that we're doing when we're doing comparison. Traditionally, or the traditional account of cognitive comparison is this, that basically comparison is a process of intersection of common features, much like Venn diagram. So if you're comparing the bicycle and the skateboard over here, you will list each of these objects. It can be object, events, whatever. You will list features of these objects, like the blue wheels, yellow, gray, and so on and so forth. Same thing with the skateboard. And then you count which features are actually overlapping with each other, like a Venn diagram. And you will get blue and wheels as the results of comparison. So this is a traditional account, intersection of common features, right? But you probably sense right away that this kind of account is problematic, okay? So if I actually give this comparison that I gave to the children, there's none of the features are actually overlapping. So using this traditional account of comparison, you will actually not get anywhere. You will not get to the common abstract structures. So my graduate advisor, Dedrick Gettner, a long time ago, actually proposed that comparison was not only intersection of common features, but more importantly, comparison is an alignment process where the objects or the events that you're comparing is not just a mere list of features, but more importantly, it has features, but it also has relations that connect the features. So instead of representing the object as a series of features, I want to represent the object as features with connected relations on top of that, such that I can actually describe it as wheel, as the features at the bottom, and then these two wheels can move together. That's like things that connect them. So they become a structural kernels. And when you do that, you do an alignment process. You still like things that look alike together, so you still align the wheels with the wheels, so things that that are similar go together. And this alignment also promote alignment at the higher structural level. So the move together now is also matched with the move together. So I'm doing this very simplistically, the theory. But the point here is that there's features, and you align the features that gives you that give you common structures. So the abstraction of common relational structure is something that you get from the process of alignment, such as these are both vehicles, which you will not get if you just merely doing intersection of common features. So this is a nice theory, but does it work, right? We have to care about whether that works or not. And what does it mean by why it works? So remember, the challenge is to ask whether comparison, which I now say is a structural alignment process, can promote learning of all kinds of relational structures, not just same and different, but a lot of different kinds of relational structures. So I can go about testing every different kind of relations. Can comparison give you this and that, but probably my life as a scientist would not be long enough to do all of those. So I have to go about a smarter way. And a smarter way is to test like the most logical, stringent question. And one of the most logical, stringent questions to answer this test is to ask whether comparison can give you learning of new relational concept. If it can give you learning of new things, of new relational concept, then you can be more confident that really this learning mechanism can promote all kinds of learning. So that's our test. We gave 4-year-olds, in this case, 3- and 4-year-olds, bizarre, novel relational concepts. And what do I mean by bizarre concept? Well, you can see the relation here is black on top, white at the bottom. Okay, you don't have anything like that in English. Like, it's not encoded in the lexicon of English. Here, small on top, big at the bottom. Here is symmetry, which is not novel for you, but we knew that it was novel for the 3- and 4-year-olds. Okay, so these are all novel for the 3- and 4-year-olds. The objects themselves are not novel. The cats are not novel, but the relations are novel. So our question is whether children can actually learn these relations. So the task is very similar as before. It's a matching to sample task. However, this task is quite sufficiently more difficult. And why? It's because Now, instead of relational match and completely something else that's just distracting you so you can be a chance, I also gave another viable option. And what do I mean by viable option? What I mean is that there's actually nothing really wrong if you decide that if I ask you which of these two matches this one, you actually want to match this picture card, right? Because you can match the cat with the cat. And that's not a wrong thing, but I'm interested about whether you actually prefer the object match or the relational match, right? So you may actually have a different preference. You may not actually prefer relational matches. So the 3 and 4-year-olds, when we tested this, actually chose, you probably could guess, the object match 98% of the time. So we gave a lot of trials to the 3-year-olds, and 98% of the time they say, obviously, this is the match. They were very confident about that, okay? So this gives us a really interesting scenario in which we want to know, well, if they are very focused on this object match, how could they ever get to the relational matches? So our test is comparison. So in another condition, so we tested another group of children, we gave them the comparison condition. So now there are two cards, and the test is the same for both conditions. Obviously, we need to have the same test. You notice something very interesting here, which is if comparison is merely intersection of common features like the traditional account. Now, when I give you the cat picture card and the dog picture card, you may actually be more likely rather than less likely to go with the object match, right? But our theory is that comparison also can highlight common structures. So even though you may be tempted to go with the object match, we actually predict that the comparison should give you the relational match. And indeed, that's what we found. So the 3 and 4-year-olds in the comparison condition in the red bar are more likely than the group in the solo condition to choose the relations. Okay. Some of you skeptics out there will immediately notice that, hey, wait a minute. The comparison group get two things. So maybe it's not about alignment. It's not about the process. But it's about just getting two things. More is always better. Okay. And this is a legitimate concern, and we have to answer this concern. Then, indeed, whether the advantage that we saw in the comparison group is truly due to getting alignment or is just seeing more exemplars. So to answer this, we tested by saying that if comparison as alignment is truly what really matters here, then if you get two samples, without being able to align them, then the children should stay preferring object matches, just like those in a solo group. But if getting if alignment is irrelevant, as soon as you get two things, then they should be behaving like the comparison group, right? So to answer this, we created the new condition in the middle, sequential condition. So the children in the sequential group get two exemplars, but it's presented one after another. In other words, even though they get two exemplars, they could not spatio-temporally juxtapose them. They could not align them. It's very difficult for children to align these two. You as adults may be able to do so. So this is, it's not about the sequential about the sequentialness of the method. It's about whether you can align them or not, right? So the children could not align this. We know that. But they got two exemplars nevertheless, okay? So they couldn't align them, but they get two exemplars nevertheless. And we also rerun a new group of children in the solo in the comparison condition. We replicated our previous results that the comparison group is, again, much better than the solo group in choosing the relational matches. And now, what about the sequential? Well, the sequential looks actually like the solo group. Visually, they look higher, but this is actually not significant from the blue bar. And they are different from the red bar. So when children get two exemplars but are not able to compare them, then they behave as if they only saw one exemplar. In other words, the alignment really matters. It's not just more is always better. The alignment really matters. And now we have also answered our stringent test that comparison can give us learning of new relational concepts. And it's not merely intersection of common features, but more importantly, of common relations. So it convinces us that it can really give us learning of a lot of different kinds of relations. And more is not always better, but you really need the alignment for this to happen. Okay, so this is a very good learning theory, in the at least at the beginning. But as a cognitive scientist, you would not be happy at this stage. You also want to make sure that your learning theory is viable. And what I mean by viable is that in all these experiments, I gave the children, the learners, the comparison, right? So I gave them explicitly, here's how, what you should compare, and what do you get from that. In order to propose a learning theory, you must also account for the accessibility of the learning theory. In other words, the humans actually use this learning theory. And so one thing we can ask is that what initiate comparisons? So if the comparison cannot be initiated by other things except by the experimenter giving you explicitly, then that's not a very satisfying learning mechanism. Okay? So in the second part, I want to ask what actually initiates comparison? Is it a viable learning mechanism? And I'm going to give you the answers right away and then go through about trying to convince you that these answers are make sense. Okay? So is comparison a viable learning mechanism? Do other things other than explicit experimenter doing the comparison initiate comparison? And the answer is yes for two things that I have proposed. One is that language can invite alignment. And second, attention to object matches can invite alignment. So these two things, they are available all the time. And in fact, they can invite alignment. So how does it work? How does language invite comparison, invite alignment? It's actually not that complicated. So my theory is this. If you have the assumption, all of you have the assumption, that same labels refer to same things, and you probably do, because we know this from studies. We also know that even young children have this assumption that same label refer to same thing. And that means that whenever you hear common labels, you actually are invited to compare. And once you compare, you can get to the relation, right? That's the theory already say that. So something like this, if you hear idempotence in an elevator, somebody was in an elevator and say, I just did an idempotence procedure, and you don't know what idempotent is, doesn't matter, you probably ignore it. But then the next day you went to a computer science lecture and you hear the word idempotent again. You may not know what idempotent means, but because you assume that same labels refer to same things, you are be invited to compare. What's the same between the elevator scene and the lecture scene that I just heard where idempotent again, right? So this is where common labels invite comparison to happen. And once the comparison happens, it can roll on getting you the relational concept. Notice something that's really interesting and powerful about this. That is, you don't have to know the meaning of idempotent, right? Any common labels will do. And that is very powerful for learning, because that means that the learners do not need to come with a lot of background. You can just, the only thing you need is the assumption that same labels refer to same things, and you can be invited to do comparison even with labels that you do not know the meaning of. So this works great for novice learners, for young children. Essentially, you don't need a lot of background, and that's really powerful. Obviously, so even novel labels should work. Obviously, we need to test this, and here's one experiment that showed that. So remember this task where young children, 2 and 3-year-olds, failed, right? If they just get this, they just randomly chose. They chose at chance. So what we did is we actually gave a label this time. This is novel label. They don't know what Truffaut means. Truffaut doesn't mean anything. It's just something that we made up. This is Truffaut, and which of these two is also a Truffaut? So assuming that children are actually know like names refer to like things, the moment they hear which of these two is also a Truffaut, then the question should invite the child to compare each of the alternatives to the standard. And when this comparison happens, hopefully, this will allow them to do the alignment process and get to the relational meaning. And that's what we found. When the 2.5 and the 3-year-olds, the 4.5-year-olds, we just did this to make sure that everything is good and nothing funky there. And so when we tested the 2-year-olds and the 3-year-olds, with just this very, very little intervention, just gave them, here's a Truffaut, which of these two is also a Truffaut, they now chose the relational matches above chance. even though this word is actually completely novel for them. So the word can invite, the common word can invite them to do comparison. The second mechanism that I propose about why comparison can really be initiated in everyday learning is that attention to object matches can invite you to do comparison. What do I mean by attention to object matches? You've seen this. You've seen this in this example where when children were given these two choices, they strongly go for the things that look similar. That's what I mean by object matches. Perceptually, they are matching, okay? Things that very easily, you can easily see right away as a matching thing. And these are very, very strong tendency in children. It actually didn't go away in adulthood, by the way. When we tested adults in these kind of things, we would get about 87 to 90% adults choosing the relations, but there will be like 13, 10% adults actually choosing the object matches. As I said, it's not a wrong option, okay? It's just the preference, the saliency change as you go cognitively more mature. But for young children, this is a very salient, and it acts like a double-edged sword because obviously at this point, they don't perceive the relations because they really, really focus on the object matches. But it also actually works to highlight to actually invite comparison. So the theory goes like this. If I give you this analogy, lioness to a cup is like hen to a chick, right? This is an analogy. There's a parent-child relation. But if you are young, you probably will never discover the relations because the relations that which is on top of there are really, really not salient to you. But if I give you this analogy instead, duck to duckling is like hen to chick. I can actually match the feature, you know, the things at the bottom, the one that you can perceive right away to be similar. I can match this at the bottom. And once I match at the bottom, it's much easier to see the structure at the top. So these kinds of, even though they have the same relational structure, the corresponding object matches will help to eventually get to the same relational structure. So that's why the object matches, even though initially it can hamper your perception of relations, it can also invite you to do comparison and alignment in the first place. So how did we test this? We test this by, again, using the relational match to sample test. And we wanted to precede it by giving them an easy initial triads of literal similarity. So same relations and same objects. So the children, the 2 and 3-year-olds, are now getting these triads. And forget about the relations. What you can see is that the triangle matched the triangle. Okay. So when children were given this, then they 100% of the time will be able to do this very correctly. And then they went on to the hard task, which, again, without any kind of interventions, without any kind of manipulations, they have failed to do this. The question is whether these kind of manipulations will allow them to see the relational matches. Now, as a good psychologist, you always have to have a control. So we don't want the conclusion to be, it's simply that they got more training, right? So we did a control group where the control group didn't get the easy matches, but in fact, they get just more of the actual tests. So if it's just about getting more practice, in fact, the control group get more practice, right? They went on to the same test, 2 groups of children, one in the object match first, the other one in the control group. We don't get results from the 2.5-year-olds because apparently the 4 initial matches is actually not enough for them. But for the 3-year-olds, it actually made a lot of difference. So when you actually are seeing the 3-year-olds, when the 3-year-olds who saw those simply 4 easy initial match, just like this easy object match, they could actually went on to do the more difficult relational matches, right? So we saw a big difference between the object match and the control condition, which is just a chance. See, getting more practice didn't help them, but getting the right kind of practice, it's not a practice, getting the right kind of things, which is the easy similarity, helped them. Okay. More recently, we actually asked these very intriguing questions. Well, what happened with animals? Okay. What happens with other animals? And we got a very intriguing result that suggested perhaps this strong attention to object matches may be unique to humans. So when we tested orangutans, chimpanzees, bonobos, and 3-year-olds, and we did this with identical procedure, we actually get a very intriguing result. So here's the study. The study is just a very easy hide and seek procedure. It's a spatial mapping procedure, and we want it to be very simple because we want the study to be identical for the three-year-olds and for the apes, right? And you can't ask many questions to the apes, so you have to make it exactly identical, right? So because this has to be comparable, we're comparing the two of them. So in the first phase of the study, so basically I'm going to hide an object or food in the hiding box, and then the participant has to search it in the finding box. And there are two rules about how you can search correctly. So in the first phase of the study, this is the first phase, I wanted to know about only relational ability. So how do you go about relational in your relational ability? So I showed the participants show this, either in this aligned condition or in the shifted condition. So in the aligned condition, when I hit a grape, this is the favorite food of the orangutans and the chimpanzees and the bonobos. They like grape very much, so they're very motivated to do this study if I hit a grape. So when I hit a grape on the top container, then you should find it in the aligned top container. Top to top, middle to middle, bottom to bottom. So that's the align rule. In the other conditions, different groups of subjects, I created an arbitrary condition, arbitrary rule that I call the shifted condition, top to middle to bottom to top. And simply the question is that even though a priori you should not expect one rule to be easier than the other, if you favor alignment, then you should be better in the aligned condition than in the shifted condition. Okay, do you follow me? Great. So what did we find? So we tested apes and children, great apes and children in identical ways, and the black bar is in the aligned conditions, the checkered bar is in the shifted condition, and the y-axis is just proportion of correct searches. Chance is 33% because there are three locations. What you can see here is that very clearly for the pun, this is our chimpanzees and bonobos, we have to group them together because otherwise we don't have enough participants. It's much harder to get participants from chimpanzees and bonobos than from children. So when we tested it, you see a very clear pattern that the pun and the children are equally good in getting the relational alignment. So in this task, in this comparable spatial mapping task, even our other great apes are really good at getting spatial relational matches. Okay, the Pongo was not successful, and we don't know why, but they were not doing well in the task. In the second phase of the study, we wanted to ask a question that I just posed to you, which is about the object matches. So now we kept the rule, but we actually change the containers. So now there's a green container, yellow container, red container. And you can see right away what does it do to the task. So if you actually are attracted by the object matches, right, if you actually are attracted by doing green to green, yellow to yellow, red to red, then you would be really confused in the aligned condition. Okay. On the other hand, in the shifted condition, if you like green to green, yellow to yellow, red to red, you should be doing very, very well. Okay? So we purposely created that way. The same participants stayed in the either aligned or shifted conditions, so they already knew the rule, in fact. But if they really, really favor object matches, if they found object matches salient, then they should do very well in the shifted condition, but not in the aligned condition. And because the presumption is that other animals, non-human animals, we're animals too, by the way, right? But non-human animals are more concrete than us, than humans, then the field has always assumed that obviously other animals will do the object matches very easily. And there were some indications, like my collaborator and I just have in some previous studies, that made us doubt this, and for the first time ever, we directly tested this hypothesis that maybe it's different in other animals, even though we always thought that they are more concrete than us. Okay, so when we tested this, remember again, this is the really, really easy task, and if you are very concrete, you like object matches, you should do very well in this, and we actually predicted in the beginning that everybody should do very well in it, everybody meaning all the great apes, and including human children. But what we found was not that, and this is the fun of doing experiment. What we found is only the children were very, very attentive to object matches. The great apes were not. They were not. It's not that they are not affected, because you can see their performance actually went down. So they were somewhat affected, but they did not find the object matches as salient as the young children. Okay, this was a very surprising result. And again, we have replicated this, but and it's a very surprising result that gives us a large implication. And that large implication is this, that the opportunity to compare is does not come easily to other species. And when the opportunity to compare does not come easily to other species, at the very least, using this route, you don't get a lot of relational learning. So the lack of frequent comparison that other species are facing may actually be contributing to the fact that what we can do with our relational thinking is very, very far from what other species can do. Surely, yeah, sure. I mean, the ducklings have like sameness and difference, but they don't have language. They don't have verbs, right? They don't have nouns. So this route can actually give you this this gap between humans and other animals in terms of their relational thinking. I don't get to talk about my language work, but I want to give a plug to Jordan Ciesias' work on how this attention to object matches can actually may affect language acquisition. So this is coming up in the Sigma Psi poster session on Thursday and Friday. So I encourage you to go to Jordan's poster and learn about how object matches can affect language acquisition. So far what we've learned is that comparison is a structural alignment process resulting in learning novel relational concepts. And initiated by common labels and attention to object similarity, I provide very specific mechanisms about how it can be initiated in the first place. So it's a viable learning theory. And in this last part, what I want to do is see about how is comparison used actively by the learners in everyday learning. In particular, I want to look at how this cognitive process of comparison manifests in a social learning and in a social domain. I'm going to look at information exchange, social inference, and also cultural learning. And most of these works are actually done by my students here at Swarthmore. So it's very exciting a time for us to look at this question. So the first kind of comparison in information exchange came from my personal experience. And this is my personal experience when I was about to buy a car. So the saleswoman over here said that, oh yeah, that car over there has good mileage and spacious. Whereas this other car that you're considering is very safe and has a great resale value. And I stop and think, what do you mean that this car is very safe? Do you mean to say that the other car is not safe? Okay. And my bet is that I didn't ask that question to her. But my bet is like, if I asked that question to her, she would probably say, oh no, this other car is also safe. But then I would actually counter back by saying, well, then you're not giving me any good informative comparison, right? So in other words, these things that she gave me were not alignable. And because the comparison was not alignable, it was not informative for me, or at least it didn't help me to make a decision because they were not alignable. So the alignability of the comparison gives you informativeness, okay? And here's how it's actually even more prevalent. If, let's say, you're learning the adjective blue, by the way, all children have to learn the adjective blue at some point, right? So pretend that you're learning the adjective blue, and I have these two kinds of comparison. I call them low align because they don't look like each other, and high align because they look like each other, right? And I say, this is blue, and this is also blue. And I know the objects. The only thing I don't know is about, I'm learning about blueness. I don't know what blue means. So if I give you these two comparisons, which of these two comparisons is more informative for you to learn blue? The one on the left or the one on the right? The low line or the higher line? Low line. Great. You got the intuition right away that the low line condition is more informative. Okay. If I change... if I change it now to a contrastive wording, so I say, this is blue, but this is not blue, you can see right away that this is that the higher line is the one that's more informative, right? So these two situations is, I created these two situations because I want to make sure it's not about two objects or two of the same objects, but it's about how the alignment gives you the informativeness. Okay. So now you get this intuition that some alignments are good, meaning that they can give you very good information. Some alignments are less good in giving you good information. So in the experiment, we actually asked when children are learning from others, when they're, because children really like learning from others. We too, we also learn from others, right? So it's a very important process in our social learning. So when children are learning to others, do they actually prefer to learn from a teacher who uses more informative alignment? So the study setup is exactly what I showed you before, except that now we use novel adjectives. So there is Mr. Green, the teacher, or Mr. Purple, the teacher. And Mr. Green will consistently use a low-aligned cards and taught using this is Feppy, and this is also Feppy. It's a novel word, okay? And he would use four different cards over here. All of them are low-alignable cards. And Mr. Purple will actually use high-alignable cards. All of them are high-alignable cards, okay? So here's in one condition. It's called the multiple exemplars because the sentence, the language is this is and this is also. In a different condition, again, the same logic. I use this is but this is not. There's Mr. Green over there and Mr. Purple over here. Okay. So our question here is this. Can children actually prefer this teacher who give better alignment in this condition and this teacher who give better alignment in this condition? The test for the children after they saw both teachers taught using two different kinds of cards consistently is this. Well, you know that both teachers actually spoke the monster language, but I don't know what to call this in a monster language, and clearly you don't either. And you need to ask one of the teachers, who do you want to ask? Who do you trust to give you the information? Okay. Obviously, children can just choose at random, which means that they are not sensitive to the how the comparison gives you information. But that's not actually what we found. So when we asked them, do you want to ask Mr. Purple or Mr. Green, then this is what we found. In the contrast condition, children actually chose the high-aligned teacher. It doesn't matter whether it's Mr. Purple or Mr. Green. We counterbalance it. Half of the children saw Mr. Purple using the high-aligned. The other half saw Mr. Green using the high-aligned. But overall, they chose the high align, which is the more informative teacher. And same thing in the multiple condition. It's not about the two objects or the different objects. It's about the informativity. So in the multiple condition, the more informative one, as you have gone through together, is the low align condition. And that's what the children chose when they ask, you don't know how to call this. Who do you want to ask? We also replicated the pattern when we asked them explicitly. Like, overall, who do you think is the better teacher? Is Mr. Purple or Mr. Green the better teacher? And we got the exact same pattern, which is really cool. And these are three-year-olds, by the way. They're very young, but they are sensitive to the comparison. And they can actually make judgments about who gives you a better information and who to trust better based on the informativity of the comparison. In the next study, what we did, Winter Lasteria and David Fialkov actually wanted to ask the question, well, what about is information exchange, right? So what about the children when they give information themselves? So we switched the role. The logic is identical, but we switched the role. Now it's actually the children are actually the one who's teaching. Okay, so everything is the same as before, except that because it's the children who is teaching, they have to teach something that they know. So it's no longer novel things, but they teach things like blue, shiny, round. And the children saw a video of someone who doesn't speak English. And they saw two different sets of picture cards. Okay, and they have to choose. You need to pick the best card to teach Anna the word blue. Which set of cards do you want to use? So now the children are the teachers. And the question is, do they pick randomly, or do they actually pick a card that actually is more informative? And what we saw here, in the multiple exemplars, children pick randomly. So arguably, when you are in the teacher role, it's much harder. So we don't see evidence that they actually they're actually using informativity. But in the contrast condition, we did see that evidence. Okay, so in the contrast condition, the children, 3-year-olds who are now the teachers, are saying, "I want to use these cards," and indeed, those are the cards that is more informative. So they can also use, when they themselves are the teachers, they can also use the comparison as being to show which one is the most informative to teach others. We asked about comparison also in thinking about evidence that we gather from the world. So this is work with Rongji Liu. And Rongji was asking the question or noticing that, well, we have to make generalization. Sometimes, actually a lot of the times, we have to make generalizations. And guess what? The generalizations that we make are based on limited data. That means not a single one of you can encounter all the data that are available in the world, right? You have to make generalization based on the limited data. And in other words, you need to rationalize, you need to be able to rationalize which evidence are good and which ones are less good. So the example is like this. If you've taken Bio 1 and Bio 2, and Bio 1 and Bio 2 are both challenging, you're probably not going to be right away concluding that all Swarthmore classes are challenging, right? You'll be a little careful to draw that generalization. However, if you took Bio 1 and Religion 8, and both of them are challenging, then you'll be more likely now to generalize that all Swarthmore classes are challenging. At the very least, you'll be more likely to do that encountering Bio 1 and Religion 8 than the Bio 1 and Bio 2. Do you get this intuition? So that means that the diverse set of evidence, you're more likely to generalize from a diverse set of evidence than from a narrow set of evidence. Okay? So these kind of inference, inductive inference for generalization may matter a lot in our social inference. So what Rongji asked is this an actual application in a social inference. So we told 5- and 6-year-olds, here is a school that you haven't been to. It's called the Jiffy School. And these are the Jiffy children. And you need to help me buy a toy that makes most of the Jiffy children happy. So these Jiffy children like toy A, which is inside the bag. We don't want to show them the toy because it's not about the toy. It's about the inference that you make about the people, right? These Jiffy children like toy A. These Jiffy children like toy B. So which toy do most of the other Jiffy children like? Which toy should I buy to make everybody happy? Okay? Almost everybody happy, at least. And if you do the rationale that we just went through together, then you should pick toy A, right? Because this is the more diverse evidence that you get, race-wise, okay? And you should pick toy A and not toy B. But this is what we found. Children actually pick this only 30% of the time, okay? So they pick this 30% of the time. You could say, well, children who are not rational beings, they have to grow up in order to be more rational like us. But notice that this is actually, they were not choosing at chance. It's not that they were random, right? They are actually 70% of the time prefer that narrow evidence, okay? So it's not that they were random. This actually gives us a very interesting further question. Why did they choose that? Why did they choose the narrow evidence, okay? It's because they're not random. We can ask this question. And one of the things that Rongji proposed is that, well, maybe they actually were doing this because these are children from the Swarthmore community, and all our participants are white Caucasian, and maybe what the children are used to are also white friends. Okay, so even though they are asked to generalize in the most abstract sense, for them they believe they should be generalizing to the population that they know. And this population that they know are consistently most of like white friends. And so it actually makes more sense to say toy B, which are liked by these groups of children, are the ones that are going to be liked by the people that I know, the people that I have to be generalizing. So if this is true, then what if we actually tell them explicitly that you have to be generalizing to truly a general population? So we tell them now, in the second study, we tell them this. Okay, so here is a picture of the Jiffy children. Make sure you pay attention. This is the picture of the Jiffy children. And you notice right away that the picture of the Jiffy children contains mixed race, right? 50% black, 50% white. And when the children were told this, this is a new group of children. Again, most of them come from Swarthmore community. All of them are white Caucasians. And we asked the same question. Everything is the same. Now, 60% of them actually chose the diverse evidence, okay? So they were actually not irrational. They were behaving on a set of belief, a set of propositions that they have, and they can rationally change their inference when you give them a different kind of evidence. And you can see how this actually makes a large implication. We haven't tested adults in this, so don't tell your friends about this study because we're testing the adults, obviously, from the Swarthmore community. Because it can make a lot of inference, right? When you make this inference, when you make this generalization, are you behaving on that familiar things that you have, or are you truly are being rational, either about beliefs or about, in this case, about like, you know, toy that you have, like about all kinds of things? Because we use this comparing of evidence for generalization in a lot of ways. So again, Rongjie is also going to present some of this work in the Sigma Psi poster, and she's doing a lot more work on this line. So if you have any thoughts, tell her. Okay, but the whitest comparison is not always informative, right? So this is work that Cynthia and I are doing together. And so, for example, if I tell you that I love the movie Foxcatcher and I hate vanilla ice cream, you're not going to learn much about me. Right? It's a very wide comparison I give between like a movie and a vanilla ice cream, but you're not going to learn about me. But if I tell you that I like the movie Foxcatcher, and I absolutely hate, truly, the movie The Martian, okay, then you probably are going to be able to draw some inferences about me. Okay, so not all the time the widest comparison is actually good for you, or actually is actually useful. And so what Cynthia was asking is precisely this question. So we want to contrast between high alignment and high entropy. In what situation you use high entropy comparison, in what situation you use high alignment comparison. So we just started this project, so I'm just going to tell you a little snippet about it. We created two different conditions where we first tell mom that Alex is a new student in your school. And during the last few weeks, you've gotten to know him well. You're excited to tell mom about your new best friend. But mom is really busy today, so she only has a very short attention span. And so she can only hear about one thing. So you have to tell her just one shot. Do you want to tell her using the high alignment comparison, or do you want to tell her using the high entropy comparison? Okay. In the other condition, Alex is a new student. You know nothing about Alex. We asked a six-year-old. And you don't know him well, but his birthday is coming up. You want to give him a nice present, and since he's shy, you can only ask him once. And you don't know nothing about Alex. So do you want to give him you want to ask him using the high alignment or using the high entropy? We predicted that in the tell condition, you should want to use the high alignment, whereas in the find out condition, because you know nothing about Alex, you want to use the high entropy alignment, okay? The high entropy comparison. So far, what we got with a very small number of n, because Cynthia just started using the study, we got completely the opposite, okay? This is the joy of doing experimental studies, okay? We got completely the opposite, so it gives us a very interesting puzzle to deal with right now, but also it might change when we run like more studies. So stay tuned for more of these results. You can ask Cynthia in a few months what we got out of this. In the last study, I want to share with you how comparison is actively used in a cultural learning. This was inspired by this kind of phenomenon, where we learn much of our cultural idiosyncrasy through imitation learning. What the child is doing here is learning a cultural act, okay? And the child learned this through imitation. And you notice that the child is doing the imitation actually happens in a group. Okay, so when the imitation happens in a group, it raises the question of whether the relations among people in the group is going to affect why and when you actually imitate. Okay? Because something that's really, really salient from looking about the group is about the relations among people in the group. And our question is whether this can actually affect how likely it is that you want to imitate a particular group. Like, think about fashion, for example, right? You see a fashion of using the hat, using a hat backward, and that's it, if it's only one person, you're probably not going to imitate it. But you see it in a lot of people doing that, you probably will imitate it. And so our question is that, what kind of relations between those people that allow you to imitate it even more? Okay? So we look at the most fundamental relations that you know very well from the very beginning of this talk, sameness and difference, which really indeed something that leaped out immediately when you are looking at a group. So you see a group, there are all kinds of relations, hierarchical relations, and so on and so forth. But something that leaps out to you is whether the group is diverse, very different from each other, the people inside it, or whether the group is very cohesive and very similar to each other. So Sona Kumar asked this question, and she's still doing this for her thesis. And what Sona did is asking whether you're more likely to imitate the diverse group or the similar group. So Sona created this video, which I'm going to play for you, and I'm going to ask your opinion, because I'm kind of ruining Sona's study in this case. So hopefully Sona even can get like some data from this audience. So the children, like you are now, are seeing this video.
Hi, I'm a flirty. This is how I show someone I'm their friend.
Hi, I'm a joggy. This is how I show someone that I'm their friend.
And then the child will so see this video.
Hi, I'm Modi. This is how I show someone that I'm their friend.
Hi, I'm Modi. And this is how I show someone that I am their friend.
Okay. So novel gestures that we made up, Sona made this up, and it has the same meaning, but the forms are different. The question is not about which form, but the question is about which group are you more likely to imitate. Obviously, the groups give you a different form, right? So we asked the child this question, now show a puppet that you're a friend. So which gesture do you want to use? And I do actually want to get like your idea. Your sense, who among you will imitate the similar group? Okay, raise your hand, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Sona, we can take this as a data. All right, so who among you will imitate the diverse group? Okay, there's definitely a lot more of a diverse group, and I think that's because you think that diverse is more generalizable. But at the cohesive, the similar group probably think because when you are similar to each other, you're also more cohesive. So think about cliques, right? A group that were very popular tend to be very similar to each other. They're very cliquish, and that may convince you to actually imitate them rather than the other way around. In other words, both are possible, and this is why it's really fun to do this study, because both are possible. Now, most of you are wrong in terms of five-year-olds. So the 5 and the 6-year-olds, it doesn't matter whether it's a chin or the forehead, overall, they prefer to imitate the similar group. So at least for 5-year-olds, they prefer to imitate the similar group. We are now uncovering why exactly, what is the rationale for this. We're the first study who showed this, and there's a lot of follow-up questions that we have to do, including doing the studies with adults as well. Okay. So I want to close by saying that one of the take-home points that I want to convey today is that we became sophisticated relational thinkers through learning. We may not have, or the 2 and the 3-year-olds may not be able to spontaneously perceive relational sameness like the ducklings do, but they could learn to do so very quickly. And what I hope I have convinced you today is that one of these learning mechanisms is comparison. And I showed in detail about how this learning mechanism can work to highlight common relational structures, so you can learn a lot of new relational concepts in the world. And that it is very feasible, because it can be initiated through things that are available to us humans, through common labels and through attention to object matches, and that it really is a pervasive mechanism that we just started to uncovering, my students and I started to uncovering about how this is used actively among social, in the social domain for social learning, how this cognitive process really manifests in everyday learning. And lastly, obviously, I want to thank many, many people especially my students who do a lot of the works that you saw here. Abigail Dean, who has been very, very helpful in getting a lot of participants, all the day schools and nursery parents and children, and the fundings that make this research happen, and also all of you for being here today. Thank you.